Hi, welcome to this week's program. Remember the first time you heard about the stock market? I'm sure it got the adrenaline up for many of you, excited about picking stocks with dreams of doubling, tripling, or 10xing your money. The early days when you hadn't tasted your first loss of capital and you were completely unaware of the dangerous pitfalls of inexperienced, untrained, and overconfident investing. It's almost like a rite of passage where the market quickly hazes newbies and shows them that it's the one that's all powerful. So, for those of you who are new to investing, let me give you some tips on how you can keep from getting burned by the market. First, now the basics of investing sound really simple in theory. Buy low, sell high, that's it. How hard can that be? Well, you'll be surprised. To make money with a simple strategy, first you have to know what low and high really mean. And remember, in the stock market, when you buy, someone else is selling. And when you sell, someone else is buying. So what you may think as high as a seller of shares would probably be considered low enough for the buyer in that transaction. So are you really smarter than your anonymous counterparty? See what I mean? How different conclusions can be drawn from the same information. So because of this hard-to-pin-down relative nature of the market, it's important to study a bit before jumping in because it's really never as simple as buy low and sell high. I always say that investing is simple, but it's not easy. So before you start investing on your own, I do believe you should read up on basic accounting so you understand terms like revenue and revenue growth, operating expenses, operating margins, operating profit, earnings per share, you know, stuff that's on the company's income statement. And you need to know about the balance sheet as well, the terms like cash and total assets and total liabilities, current liabilities, book value, those kinds of terms. You also want to understand terms like working capital and cash flow, so you're in a slightly better position to truly assess a company's financial position before you jump on someone's recommendation to buy a hot stock. You also need to know about price-to-earnings ratios and so on. You have to understand how they get calculated and what their major weaknesses are. Very important when you compare a company's stock valuation relative to its fundamentals, relative to its competitors or the market as a whole. And while you're learning, it's always good to start out by using virtual money in a stock simulator. Most likely, you'll find that the market is much more complex than a few ratios can express, but learning those and testing them in a demo account can help lead you to the next level of study. Let's talk about playing penny stocks and fads. You know, at first glance, penny stocks, which literally cost less than a dollar per share, seem like a great idea to invest in. With as little as $100, you can get a lot more shares of penny stock than the popular companies like Facebook that cost about $135 a share, or Google that costs $830 a share, right? And you may be tempted by a sizable upside if a penny stock goes to a dollar. But remember, a penny stock is a penny stock for a reason. The market doesn't believe the company warrants a higher valuation, and the company may not offer much future gain. So what penny stocks offer in position size and potential profitability may reflect high volatility and really poor expected returns. So even if you buy a stock for 50 cents, because it's more highly volatile, you can end up losing your entire 50 cents should the company tank. And that risk is much less than a Facebook or a Google. Penny stocks are also exceptionally vulnerable to manipulation. You know, getting solid information on penny stocks can be very difficult because many reputed investment companies simply do not follow them, making penny stocks a poor choice for an investor who is still learning. So beware. Penny stock pushers would love to con you into thinking that they're the path to riches, and while that's true extremely rarely, most of the time people have lost big on penny trades. As a matter of fact, on Facebook, now I see ads for the promise of making millions on penny stocks of companies involved with the commercialization of marijuana. You know, there's no easy riches, and most who get into this are going to lose everything. And it's been said, there's a sucker born every minute. So overall, I prefer you own a quality stock for a long time than try to make a quick buck on a low-quality company. We're talking about the dangers of investing, especially for first-time investors. Here's another one. Investing 100% of your capital in a specific investment is usually not a good move, even with a Google, a Microsoft, or a Facebook, because even the best companies can face issues down the road and see their shares decline dramatically. While you might have more upside if you go all in and the company does really well, you'll also have a lot more risk. Especially as a first-time investor, it's good to diversify and buy at least a handful of stocks. This way, the lessons learned along the way are less costly, but still valuable. You know, it's been said that investing or learning about investing costs money. Either you go to school and you learn it, either you hire an advisor and have a professional do it, or you do it yourself and lose quite a bit of money. And usually that third choice is the most expensive of the three. Here's another dangerous move is leveraging your money by using margin. Using margin means that you borrow money from your broker to buy more stock than you can afford. Using leverage magnifies both the gains and losses on your investment. So here's an example. Let's say you have $100 and you borrow $50, so you buy $150 worth of stock. Stock rises 10%, you make $15. $15 on $150. But that $15 is actually $15 on $100, which is a 15% return on capital. Pretty good, right? Now, if the stock declines 10%, you lose $15 or for a 15% loss, even though the stock only declined 10. More importantly, if the stock goes up by 50%, you make a 75% rate of return. That's pretty good. But if the stock declines by 50%, you're left with $75. Now, from that $75, you got to pay back the $50 that you borrowed. That leaves you with just $25. That's a whopping 75% loss of invested capital. So as a new investor, make sure you don't get lured by the siren song of margin and its potential for higher rates of return. Now, talking about investing cash you can't afford to lose is another dangerous move. Studies have shown that cash put into the market in bulk rather than incrementally has a better overall return. But this doesn't mean that you should invest your whole nest egg at one time. Investing is a long-term business, and staying in business requires having cash on the sidelines for emergencies and opportunities. Sure, cash on the sidelines doesn't earn any returns, but having all your cash in the market is a risk that even professional investors won't take. If you don't have a lot of free cash beyond your emergency cash reserves, really, stay out of the market. Putting all your money on the line makes you emotionally vulnerable and leads to investing with what is called a behavioral bias. It's a handicap, which almost predisposes you to making bad decisions. So only invest money that you can truly afford to leave in the market for long periods of time. All right, finally, whether it's trying to guess which stock will be the next Apple, investing quickly in a hot stock tip, or going all in on a rumor of earth-shaking earnings, investing on new tips is a terrible move for first-time investors. Remember, you're competing with professional firms that not only get information the second it becomes available, but also know how to properly analyze a company's performance before it announces results. Rather than following rumors, ideal first investments are companies that you understand and have a personal experience dealing with. As good as Warren Buffett is, he always invests in what he calls his circle of competence, meaning he sticks to what he knows and what he understands. And you should do the same. So remember, when you're personally buying stocks in the market, you're competing against large mutual funds and institutional investors that not only do this full time, but also have far more resources and in-depth information than the average person. Temper your expectations, start small, take measured risks with your money, with the money that you're prepared to lose. And then after you read up and become more adept at evaluating stocks, start making bigger investments. While it's tempting to bet the bank to try to make a quick buck, real money is made by slowly compounding your returns over several decades of disciplined investing. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. The desire to do the right thing is part of our basic nature, and most of us, I think, make decisions every day within this framework. In the investing world, it's no different. And because of that, a large industry of investment choices has been developed to cater to those who want to be socially responsible and foster a more sustainable and responsible investment strategy. Mark D'Souza Shields knows this industry extremely well as an international investment consultant, and he was the first executive director of the Social Investment Organization of Canada. He's also the author of a new book, Invest Like You Give a Damn, Make Money, Change the World, Sleep at Night. And he writes that the book is a user-friendly guide to socially responsible investing for investors of limited means and unlimited conscience. I like that. Let's find out more. Hey, Mark, welcome to the show.
Yeah, thanks, Steve. I'm happy to be here.
So the book is geared towards Generation X and millennials. What makes these two groups of adults so important?
Well, it's more about the different nature or the different characteristics of their financial investment needs that we address those two cohorts, so to speak. We do know about the millennials that they're set to inherit many trillions of dollars of assets. So that makes them sort of on the sustainability front, very, very important. Mm-hmm. But at the same time, Gen X are open to these kinds of ideas and they do control significant assets, obviously. So we decided just to focus on their specific needs.
I think those generations too have been more exposed to the idea of socially responsible investing, more so than the baby boomers who, even though we kind of come out of a culture of the 60s, many of us, you know, basically put on our three-piece suits and kind of followed a traditional, more traditional path.
Well, you know, in the book, I looked at that specific question and we found that the boomers actually really wanted to try and do something different, you know, from the 1960s and the hippie movement and all that stuff. But you're right, we put on our suits and sort of moved on. I'm sort of right at the cusp of boomers, Gen X. And we saw that the Gen X actually wanted to do a lot more and expressed a lot of ideas about living differently, especially later in our lives, you know, with work-life balance. But the millennials, it seems, are actually, in enough numbers anyways, looking for greater purpose in life. But I don't want to confuse that with, and the book doesn't do this, with, you know, saving the world and doing sustainable this or sustainable that.
Yeah.
Really what it means is they want and they are actually actuating greater work-life balance. And I think that that's an opening for sustainability because a lot of the things that we did as Gen X and boomers was consume too much without any kind of conscious understanding of what that meant for the world ultimately. So we see a lot of millennials, you know, becoming organic farmers or working part-time on purpose or doing the gig economy. And it's important their relationships with each other, their relationships with their communities. And that's a real opening for, I think, sustainable investment.
Well, let's talk about the investments themselves. So how much right now is invested in the SRI or the socially responsible investing movement right now?
Well, the last tally that we have is just over $6 trillion, which is a substantial portion of the...
Sounds like a lot.
It seems like a lot. It's a substantial portion. But you got to understand, a lot of that is relatively passive. It doesn't have a lot of direct and proactive impact. Mm-hmm. So that would be tobacco screens, military screens, these sorts of things.
Meaning that you screen out for certain kinds of companies, vice companies, and as you say, maybe armament companies, military, and so on. Yeah. Okay.
A screen is simply, you know, saying, you know, look, if you have this much in military sales, you're not going to be invested in.
Okay.
You know?
Mm-hmm. Now, is that $6 trillion, has that risen pretty dramatically over the years?
It's been fairly constant, to be honest. I think in the early 2000s, it started rising a lot faster than in the 1990s. And so we started seeing some real assets pile up in the last few years with divestment from coal. But one might argue that just a smart investor would have started divesting from coal.
Yeah. As a declining industry, it was pretty obvious to see. So, you know... Yeah. I've been in the business a long time investing, and there used to be a choice that you'd make. You know, do you want to perform well in the markets or let's say make yourself rich, or do you want to invest in things that do good? There used to be a dichotomy there because the things that you were investing to do good didn't necessarily follow the markets or do well. Has that changed?
Well, the perception has changed. The evidence has always been that with SRI, just like any other kind of investment strategy, if you pick the right funds or you pick the right investments, you're going to do as well as or better than whatever your peer competitor fund or stock might be or security might be.
Mm-hmm.
The Oxford University did a meta study of over 200 rigorous academic studies on SRI and found that to be the case. You're either going to slightly outperform or you're going to meet the performance of whatever benchmark investment you're looking at. If you go into Morningstar, you can check out any individual SRI fund. They do a fabulous job, by the way, of looking at the sustainability performance of different funds. And you'll find the evidence is clear. You know, many funds outperform. Like one of my favorite funds, I have a 15-year-old daughter. I want her to have all the opportunities that my boys have. And one of my favorite funds is PAX Elevate Women's Global Fund. And it's 26th out of 1,500 peer funds.
All right, let's get into that for a second, because that's an area that is relatively new, kind of gender-based ETFs with the concept that if a company has a very open policy to adding more females to their staff, that this makes a better company, more diverse, and, you know, smarter in some ways.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's not your typical remove tobacco, remove gun, you know, companies. This is kind of different. So tell us about that area a little bit.
Well, the general idea is that you want to have a stronger impact, so you're more proactive. PAX Elevate, for example, looks for companies that have women on their boards. Now, I want to say two things about that. The first thing is the diversity is really, really important, as you point out, but the economy is moving towards more and more collaboration between countries, between companies, with NGOs, with governments. And, you know, women have a skill set in terms of collaboration that men don't always have. And so this just makes great business sense as we move towards a more collaborative economy to have greater diversity and to have that skill set become part of the core skills of a company. And you see the companies like Unilever and Nike and Patagonia that are real sustainability icon in business having taking that approach. Lots of collaboration and lots of diversity.
Interesting. You know, I think there's some complications in investing in socially responsible companies because, you know, many of the companies have both good and bad aspects to them. It's not quite so simple or so black and white. So how does one make or discern whether a company is acceptable by at least basic standards if they've got some good and bad things going on?
Well, you hit the nail on the conundrum's head, essentially. Take Walmart, for example. Fantastic environmental approaches to business. Really doing great things. I mean, they pioneered the square milk box and saved 20% on carbon just like that for their transport and logistics and whatnot. Yet they got caught out in Mexico with a huge corruption and bribery scandal.
Yeah.
There's two ways to approach it. The first way, if you are an investor and you're passionate about a particular issue, go with that issue and hold your nose on the rest of the stuff. A woman in the book that I interviewed, she loves recycling and environmental issues, and she bought Ford Motor Company because they were playing around with having edible recycled bumpers on their cars. And now Ford's got $11 billion commitment to electrical cars. So, you know, you have to follow your passion and follow the companies and sometimes hold your nose. At a more general level, you can look for these companies or funds that are trying to have a positive impact. So you look at, for example, there's a lot of funds that are looking at supporting municipalities and their development efforts. Mm-hmm. You know, you can see the impact on the ground. So you can do that. And there's other financial levers that you can use, including banking with your local community credit union, which lends to people in your community. And then recently, there's been legislation in the United States to allow non-accredited investors or smaller investors to put up to 10% of their portfolios in all those crazy things that are really changing the world, the social enterprises that, you know, are super local, organic food, organic breweries, all these kinds of wonderful things, which I call HUGs, huge, uncomplicated gratification investments.
And so, you know, staying local is probably a good way. So I think it's investing with a list of tenets that you want to follow and some presence of mind as to exactly where your money is going and what it is doing. My guest is Mark D'Souza Shields. The book is Invest Like You Give a Damn, Make Money, Change the World, Sleep at Night. Mark, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you very much, Steve.
To hear this again, listen to the full show, or to get a summary of the vital info discussed here today, go to stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update where we'll send you every weekly commentary and interviews from the show, including searchable archives if you think you've missed something. Straight to your inbox. That's stevepomerantz.com. Are there any topics we're missing? Guests we haven't thought of that you'd like on the show? Questions you want answered? Contact us anytime at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. Simply go to stevepomerantz.com and click Contact to write us anytime, anywhere. Articles on the site you liked or didn't? Want to share your 2 cents? Comment on any of our guest interviews and tell us. You know, this show's purpose is to empower and protect you on all things financial. We'd love to hear your feedback so we can make sure we're getting you the information you need to live your one best financial life. Contact us at any time at stevepomerantz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. There was a time when most baby boomers thought we would never get old. We baby boomers share a collective memory, Beatlemania, rock and roll, TV shows like The Howdy Doody Show, which I'm sure most of you have never heard of, The Mickey Mouse Club, which was wonderful, The Twilight Zone, which scared us, and even the lighthearted Happy Days. Now we're aging and we're seeing that a large percentage of our parents, you know, members of the greatest generation, are now gone, and we're now more aware of our own mortality. So issues that would have generated little interest from us just 20 years ago are now starting to grab our attention. We're looking at trusts, we're looking at our estates, and learning more about financial elder abuse so we can prepare for what inevitably will come. Our generation is not one to stand for the status quo either, so we figure out ways of helping ourselves, we innovate ways of helping ourselves and our parents and our children. And this is becoming more meaningful for us year by year. Now, one individual who has worked and written about this field is attorney Michael Hackard, whose new book, The Wolf at the Door, Undue Influence and Elder Financial Abuse, gives us insight into this world and the tools to protect ourselves and our family. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thank you for having me.
So you write that 1 in 10 seniors, 5 million people, are victims of elder abuse and neglect every year. Really, you say it's a silent epidemic of crime. Give us a sense of the situation.
Well, it truly is a silent epidemic. A lot of it has to do with the aging of America. You know, there are about 40 million people now that are age 65 and above. I think that's about 13% of the population. By 2029, we're said to be 20% of the population. So you just see this higher incidence of abuse. And 1 in 9 seniors, in fact, is reported being abused, neglected, or exploited in the last 12 months in whatever fashion. So it's a big problem.
Yeah. So and that's only the ones that are reported. How much of this actually goes unreported?
Well, the interesting thing, it's said that only 1 in 44 cases is actually reported. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. That's an astounding number.
Yeah. All right. So this is something that is kind of, you know, quiet that's going on, that's gets some press once in a while. We're trying to bring it out into the light here as well. So where does this abuse generally come from? Is it institutions? Is it family members? How does that break down?
Well, unfortunately, it's about 90% family members and caregivers, with family members being the majority of it. Now, in identifying family members that do this, I throw in a few caveats, but in my experience, and I think the general experience is, it's when it's a family member, he's usually a dependent child who's not working, maybe has substance abuse, and for a matter of months or even years is living with a parent and fully financially dependent on that parent. And of course, ultimately, the parent becomes dependent on that child and very vulnerable.
Yeah, I've seen that in my own practice. But I mean, there's a good side to that as well, because if other siblings are busy running their lives, maybe they live in different parts of the country, it's comforting to know that you've got a sibling that's, you know, in the house taking care of things. Where does it go over the line?
Well, it goes over the line when the other siblings start getting isolated from their parent. Almost that the abusing child, in that case, has a feeling like of ownership mm-hmm. of the parent, mm-hmm. of the access to the parent, isolates the parent, and ultimately a feeling of ownership and somehow deserving or being entitled to the parent's assets. Yeah. That's when it goes over the line.
Wow.
Way to rebut it is to have full transparency between the siblings, where, you know, one agrees to do one thing and one another, however it is that's split up, so that somehow, even if they're across the country, there's some participation.
Checks and balances,
That's a good way to say it.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about your background. So your attorney dealing in estates and trusts, how did you come into this area of the practice?
Well, when I started as a lawyer over 40 years ago, I was in an estate and trust. Well, then it was basically an estate and wills law firm.
Okay.
And none of the senior members wanted to litigate. And I did. Mm-hmm. I thought it was fun. Mm-hmm. I still do. And so back in those days, I started to do will contest. And I was successful at it, enjoyed it, got away from it for a long time. And now in my, 40 some years of practice, about 5 years ago, I think I just started to step up, seeing that what was happening and with baby boomers and with people that I knew and their parents, and I thought, well, it's time to get back in. Mm-hmm. And now getting back in, it's a changed world. Yeah. Because whether you're in Florida or New York or California, the use of trust, irrevocable trust and revocable trust or living trust is widespread. And 40 years ago, it wasn't that way at all. And of course, now elder financial abuse is widespread in our, we live longer. We have different diseases when we live longer.
Yeah,
things have changed.
Yeah. So what was once something that would end a person's life is now turned into a chronic illness that's manageable, and people are living a lot longer. But, then there are issues of cognitive impairment and physical impairment and things that now come in that, we all are familiar with as we live longer. So if I'm a sibling, and just for the moment, forget this idea that I've got another sibling living in the house, what are some of the signs that I should look for? Because I'm kind of busy with my own world, and I'm assuming I'm hiring a professional and they're telling me everything is fine. What are some of the telltale signs I need to look for?
Well, telltale signs that include liabilities and unpaid bills.
Okay.
That means somebody's taking some money. Sometimes you'll see transfers of Social Security or VA accounts. Sometimes that's absolutely necessary and important, but other times it's just a way to obstruct any kind of transparency into the senior's life. And suspicious withdrawals, vanishing assets. You go in the house and, hey, where's the silver set, or where is this or that? Those are some of the things that become obvious. And secrecy with regard to estate documents. Sometimes a child, I've seen it many times, where a child says, oh, don't worry about it, brother or sister. It's all under control. I've got it under control. Well, if it's under control, let's share those documents and know what's going on.
Yeah. Yeah. With my stepfather years ago, we had a caretaker, and we found that there were calls to the Bahamas on his phone, and I think it was Haiti at the time. And, obviously he was not making those kinds of calls. So, that was a quick sign for us, an easy one to say, hey, it's obvious who made these calls, and, we were able to get rid of her. But I guess even just little things like that you need to watch out for. When do you get an attorney involved? At what point do you, you see some kind of crime being committed, do you call the police? What are your first steps there?
Well, I think it does make sense to get an experienced attorney, someone knowledgeable in the area, when you start seeing those signs, when you suspect things that are going on. And I can think of things over the years, such as people that are going to the local Safeway or other store and are supposed to just be buying food, and you see, $400 for a grocery bill, which is what's happening as a caretaker, or somebody's taking out an additional $300 in cash. Mm-hmm. Or you see suspicious bank accounts, those kind of things. I think you do bring in lawyers, experienced lawyers. The other thing is, many times people call Adult Protective Services. We have them throughout the country. Mm-hmm. And I think they're very important, but you do get mixed reviews on them.
We had a situation in our own practice where we did call them, and they were terrific, I have to say. They solved the problem. They brought in the police. They took care of the people that were taking advantage of this client of ours. And they got him situated in a good assisted living facility. I was very, very happy with that. Just a personal note.
Yeah, and that's terrific. And there are a lot of success stories. I admire them for what they do. I do have the caveat that it's not it's not the magic bullet per se, because sometimes they'll just go out and visit the elder and speak to him or her alone and say, is everything okay? The elder says, okay.
Yeah.
And they're gone.
That's right. Well, in this case, the elder was saying, I'm fine. I don't have a problem. I know these people. I like these people, but we could tell that he was being abused. I want to talk briefly. We don't have much time, but setting up trusts means that there's trustees that can take over in times of, you know, parental, let's say, decline. And how do you watch the trustees? What rules do they have? They have rules to follow. Who's minding the store there? What's one of your experiences with that?
Well, yeah, once they become the trustee, they do have throughout the state some duty to account to the maker of the trust, as well as to beneficiaries that are vested, say. Mm-hmm. We get into trustee fights all the time. And I have lots of examples, but there's one going on right now that's a securities firm, essentially. And their annual fees of what they're taking out of this trust are twice the amount of what's being distributed to beneficiaries. Mm-hmm. I mean, this wasn't really set up to benefit the securities firm.
Right.
So when you see secrecy in trustees, you see overbilling, sometimes horrendous overbilling.
Yeah.
You know, $500,000 in fees to a trustee, ridiculous.
That's ridiculous.
Mm-hmm. But, you know, you got a problem and somebody needs to step in.
Yeah, gotcha. The book is The Wolf at the Door, Undue Influence and Elder Financial Abuse. All proceeds from the sale of this go to the Alzheimer's Foundation, right?
That's right. That's a good spot to go. They do great work in terms of helping people with Alzheimer's and families and helping bring issues so that they can be addressed in public policies.
I've read the book. It's a good book. It's a necessary book if you find yourself approaching that situation or in that situation. Once again, The Wolf at the Door, Undue Influence and Elder Financial Abuse. My guest is attorney Michael Hacker. To hear this segment again and to hear all of our segments on our show, do not forget to go to our website, which is stevepomerantz.com. Don't forget that we podcast, we use all forms of social media for you to get to us. And if you sign up at our website, we'll send you a weekly update of every segment that we do, where you can listen to the segment individually, read a summary about it, or read the transcripts. It's all there for you to enjoy this information that we provide to you. Michael Hackard, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Steve.
Little boxes on the hillside, little boxes made of ticky-tacky, little boxes on the hillside, little boxes all the same. There's a pink one and a green one and a blue one and a yellow one, and they're all made out of ticky-tacky and they all look just the same.
This is the Steve Pomerantz Show, and I'm Steve Pomerantz. It's time for Real Estate Roundup. This is the time every single week we get together with noted real estate agent Terry Story. She's a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida. Welcome back to the show, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
Well, housing prices have gone up. People are paying their mortgages every month, so their amount of outstanding balance is declining.
Yep, that's good.
And therefore, that means that the amount of tappable equity, the amount between what you owe and what the house is worth, has grown to record levels, right?
That's right. You know, as of September, 42 million homeowners with a mortgage had nearly $5.4 trillion, with a T, in equity available to borrow against. So that's a lot of equity mm-hmm. that's available that you can use to make home improvements. Hopefully, we don't see, you know, the car buying and the boat buying kind of activity, but we are building the equity in homes, which is very, very healthy. That's what we want to see.
Right. Remember, folks, if you're going to pull money out of your home and you use it, let's say, for home improvements, while you probably won't get all that money back, you will get some of that money back. If you're going to try to invest it or try to spend it, try not to spend it on things that depreciate in value, like Terry was saying, like cars and boats, because that's, you're just wasting your money in that regard. The money that's in your home is really not meant for that purpose. You really want to build up your equity. And really, for a lot of people who can't save otherwise, their home equity is going to represent a significant part of the retirement savings. So please keep that in mind.
That's right. That's right. Now, under the recent laws that were passed, Steve, interest rate on these HELOCs are no longer deductible. So that's kind of a bummer.
It's a big deal.
Yeah. You know, I have a lot of investors that use their equity against their home to purchase investment properties. So
yeah.
I don't know if that'll discourage them. They'll figure a way to make it work out, but it was nice being able to deduct that.
Yeah, these shocks come once in a while. I remember in 1986, I started in the business as a stockbroker in 1981. And back then, these limited partnerships were all the rage, and I was young and dumb. And they also promised huge tax deductions. So I went in there, I made a 5-year commitment for an ungodly sum each year to get this huge tax deduction. 1986, they changed the law and they did away completely with the tax deduction. And when I looked at what I had left,
right,
I had really nothing good left. So it was never a good idea to make investment decisions based on taxes anyway.
That's right.
But I didn't know better. But now HELOCs, if the money you borrowed, you're not going to be able to deduct it. And that's a big deal. So it's important that everybody knows that.
Yep.
Now, I see also that Florida, as always, has another distinction in the housing market. Tell us about that.
Florida, yes, is once again among one of the highest percentage of non-current loans and seriously delinquent loans. It was interesting because I had somebody ask me that question the other day and, you know, said, hey, have you seen any foreclosures or short sales or anything? And I answered right away, no, but I realized that I actually saw a short sale the other day, and I haven't really seen one in a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. But it's no surprise that Florida took this position because we did get hit with the hurricane. So, you know, that definitely made an impact as to why we're seeing this.
Okay, so people struggling to get their homes fixed, maybe they're skipping a mortgage payment or so.
That's right.
Okay, so non-current loans means that they haven't paid up to the current amount due. They're late. And then seriously delinquent, obviously, is self-explanatory. That means that people haven't paid for a really long time.
They're later.
Yeah, probably not hurricane related. That's probably a different story.
Correct.
All right, let's go to your real estate survival guide. It's always my favorite thing. And there's a whole lot of information here about why first-time homebuyers should not shy away from the housing market. And you've listed some interesting psychological aspects as well. Let's get right to them.
Sure. Well, there are a lot of psychological reasons not to fear purchasing a home as a first-time homebuyer. One of them, believe it or not, is fear of exposing their credit history. I have several people say, well, I don't want anyone to run my credit because it's going to ding my credit.
Mm-hmm.
Well, that's really not true. When you're getting pre-approved for finance, you do need to have your credit run so we know what you're looking at, because the rate in which the interest rate varies dependent on that credit score.
Mm-hmm.
So you're not going to really ding it if you're, you know, applying for a loan.
Yeah. So don't be afraid of that. Just go forth, get your dose of reality, whatever it may be, so you can make a good decision afterwards. But don't not do it because of fear of exposing your credit history.
That's right.
Okay.
And the second one is worrying that the family will judge their home choice. You know, here's the deal with parents. When you're dealing with first-time homebuyers, I cannot tell you how many times the parents step in and kill the deal. They kill the deal by coming to look at the 50th house that the couple have looked at that they want to make an offer on,
mm-hmm.
and say, oh, that's not good enough for my son or daughter.
Mm-hmm.
But the parent has not been involved in the whole process. They have not seen the other 49 homes to really make that decision on their behalf. So
yeah,
if you're going to get a parent involved, please get them started early in the game so they understand where you're coming from.
Well, I mean, with you out in the field and putting forth all that work, and let's just use your example of 49 homes, and they finally found, you know, they have to maybe settle in a certain ways because it's just not available at their price range. I think the parents also come in and maybe they, you know, they have some home experience and they say, well, you know, look at this. This is going to cost you money later on, da-da-da-da-da. You want to bring them in really early. And I would think as a salesperson, you really want to bring them in really early.
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. And there's no problem having family members involved, but you really want them involved throughout the whole process.
Okay.
And then fear of making a huge error. You know, if you're dealing with professional people, you're not going to be making a huge error. They're going to guide you through this whole process. It is a very, you know, slippery slope ride when you're going through the buying process. But if you're very well educated and working with an experienced, trusted agent, you'll be okay. You're not going to make a huge error.
Yeah.
They're not going to let you make a huge error.
So make sure you're with someone you're comfortable with, who's, you know, giving you all the facts as you go and helping to advise you. That's what you're paying for when you have an agent. And that's what an agent should be helping you with. Do not have that fear. Well, Terry, we are out of time. So I want to thank you for joining us. Terry is a 29-year veteran with Keller Williams, located in Boca Raton, Florida, and she can be found at terrystory.com. Thanks, Terry.
Thanks for having me, Steve.
StevePomerantz.com now features each week's show in shareable individual segments. Busy at work and want to come back to the show later? No problem. Every segment has a full summary of what was discussed, along with a transcription of the interview. You can read or listen to one of my commentaries. Hey, is there something I mentioned on air you want to find on our site? Well, you can search for it. So check it out and let us know what you think. We'd love to hear your thoughts on what you liked or what you didn't. You can request topics you want us to talk about and ask us questions. We'll get back to you, promise. And you can like us on Facebook, where you'll find out about upcoming events and subscribe to our podcast. It's all there at stevepomeranz.com. That's Steve, P-O-M-E-R-A-N-Z.com. This is Steve Pomerantz, and you're listening to The Steve Pomerantz Show. My next guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jake Bernstein. He's a former senior reporter of the team that broke the Panama Papers story. I don't know if you remember that, but it was a story that investigated the world of the firm Mossack Fonseca, one of the largest providers of offshore shell companies and a key player in a secret economy that fuels trillions of dollars in tax evasion and criminal activity. The book is Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. Jake Bernstein, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me, Steve.
So how did you end up getting involved in this story? Where did it start?
It all begins with a phone call from a friend of mine who was the senior editor at the International Consortium of Investigative Journalists. And he said to me that they were working on something that was very interesting that he thought I would be a good fit for, and he couldn't tell me anything about it on the telephone.
Oh, no.
So I had to come to Washington, D.C. and meet with the director of ICIJ, Jared Ryle, and his deputy, Marina Walker. And they told me that they had just begun to receive data from a leak involving a law firm, Mossack Fonseca. And this was just the beginnings of it. It wasn't a lot. What ended up being 11.5 million documents before it was all said and done. But this was just the first, you know, few thousands of documents. But they already knew that they had things like a secret company of the prime minister of Iceland and companies that were directly connected to Vladimir Putin. Mm-hmm. So they were very excited. And as soon as I heard about it, I signed on. And then for the next year, I worked with investigative journalists all over the world. It ended up being about 340 all told to investigate this data. But by the time it was done, I felt like there was still large parts of the story that hadn't been told. I mean, we really had only scratched the surface. And in particular, we hadn't gotten the perspective of Ramon Fonseca and Jürgen Mossack, the people behind the firm. And so I decided to do a book and dig a little bit deeper.
And you contacted those two individuals and they were a source for the book, right?
Yeah, they spoke to me at length, actually. They were eager to sort of get out their perspective, both about how their business had evolved and this secrecy world had evolved over time, and also who they thought were the real masterminds behind this industry.
Were they doing anything illegal, those two?
I mean, the thing is they end up operating in 21 different tax havens, right? Even though they're based in Panama. So what might be perfectly legal in Panama might be not legal in the Seychelles. And a lot of this is, it's about compliance. You know, it's about vetting customers and due diligence. And it doesn't really get enforced.
Right.
So they were not following the letter of the law in the way that they were supposed to.
Okay.
We definitely say that. There are criminal investigations of their activities right now, but it remains to be seen whether they themselves will be held personally liable for things that happened.
Because some of this money comes from arms trafficking, you know, oil, gas exploration, money being siphoned off, even international soccer that you mentioned, and governments were involved. You mentioned the Prime Minister of Iceland, who resigned. Give us a quick primer on how money gets laundered overseas.
Oof, sure.
Yeah.
I mean, there's all different kinds of ways, right? And we need to say at the outset that having an anonymous shell company is not in and of itself illegal, right? It is what purpose you are putting that company toward. And so, I mean, corporations and the mega wealthy use this system all the time to avoid taxes or for legal means. And then that same sort of super highway of underground cash, if you will, is also used by money launderers and criminals and corrupt public officials and things like that. And there are lots of different ways to launder money through this system. Once you have the anonymity of a shell company and maybe a foundation or a trust, and you base it in multiple jurisdictions, you can do pretty much anything with it. Mm-hmm. And there's very little scrutiny. So, I mean, the UN sort of puts the amount of money that is laundered worldwide as high as $2 trillion. And the US Treasury Department thinks that it could be as much as $300 billion just in the United States every year.
Well, I read a quote in the book that said in 1997, more than half of the world's wealth was controlled offshore.
Yeah.
So we're talking about an awful lot of money there.
It's astounding.
What countries are we talking about that provide the safe haven for this money for the ultra wealthy?
Steve, that is a really good question, because I think one of the biggest countries that does it is going to be a surprise to most of your listeners, and it's the United States.
How's that possible?
So most people think that tax havens are things that happen in places with tropical breezes and palm trees and ocean and all that stuff.
Uh-huh.
And no, in fact, some of the biggest players are Delaware, Nevada, and Wyoming, which pump out hundreds of thousands of these shell companies. And in fact, the Treasury Department and the State Department have complained bitterly that Delaware companies are being used by Russian mafia and transnational gangs and others, but they don't seem to be able to do anything about it. And it's understandable why. Delaware pulls in more than $1 billion a year from its public registry.
Yeah.
So they have no incentive into cleaning up, you know, and finding out exactly who's behind these companies and demanding more transparency.
Well, Delaware was just in the news, I guess, with this alleged one-night stand with the president and, you know, the porn star. I believe a company was set up in Delaware. And unfortunately, I think the attorney put his name.
Yes.
I mean, if you're going to do this kind of thing, don't put your name on it, you know?
101, right?
Yeah, exactly.
And the best people who do it sort of layer it, right?
Yeah.
You'll have a trust, you know, that will be owned by a foundation, mm-hmm. and the foundation will own the company. And so, and then you can have nominee directors of the foundation or even the company in some places that are actual employees of a Mossack Fonseca that's setting this up. But to tie this off, you know, Donald Trump is no stranger to the secrecy world. He has more than, he admitted on the campaign trail that he had more than 515 separate companies, including 378 registered in Delaware.
Mm-hmm. So let's get back to Mossack and Fonseca, if I'm saying their names even close enough. How did they enter into the business, and really what was their primary business? All right, let me do it another way. I come to them and I've got a situation where I think there was an example, someone wanted to buy a home in Seattle. And I forget exactly the reason why they wanted it to be secret, but they ended up getting in touch with that firm in Panama. What happened next?
Sure. Well, the case that I talk about in the beginning of the book is a gentleman from Mexico who wants to buy a house in Seattle for his sister and his niece, but she's involved in a divorce. And he doesn't want the husband to know that he's buying this house because he doesn't want it to be subject of the divorce. So he goes to Mossack Fonseca and they help him set up a Delaware company. But again, the Delaware company is going to buy the house, but he is associated with the Delaware company. Well, how do you get around that? They also set up for him a foundation. And so the foundation is the one that owns the Delaware company. So if you look at the Delaware company that's buying the house, all you'll see is the Panamanian Foundation.
Yeah.
And the Panamanian Foundation, the members are Mossack Fonseca employees. And so it's all very neatly hidden, in this case, from the husband who's part of the divorce proceeding.
In this particular case, though, those two low-level employees have to sign off on the transfer of the money. They have to say, we approve this journal or this wire to go out from the foundation to the seller of the house.
And they did that because this Mexican businessman was buying the house in cash. So $500,000 straight out, mm-hmm. right? And it actually, this is a major problem. Another reason sort of Americans think that the system doesn't really relate to them, but property prices are skyrocketing in our major cities, in New York, in Miami, in San Antonio, in Los Angeles, in places like that. And part of the reason is that people are using these LLCs, these anonymous shell companies, to buy up property for cash, and it's raising the price of property for everyone else. And oftentimes, particularly on the high-end luxury market, these buyers are, it's either money laundering or they're corrupt officials or they're people who have gotten the money in some questionable way and are parking it in property in the United States because they believe that it'll be safe there. It won't be confiscated and there's a chance it might appreciate.
The book is Secrecy World, Inside the Panama Papers, Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. My guest is Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Jake Bernstein. So you also mentioned that it has a darker side too, and that is not only are they parking this money and they're avoiding taxes because of these offshore entities or these Delaware entities, but that hurts local municipalities in terms of their ability to provide services for the city. So they're getting the benefits of the city without actually having to pay any of the cost of these terrific benefits they're getting.
This is absolutely right. And I mean, everywhere governments are saying we don't have enough money for education, for healthcare, for infrastructure, for police, for things like that. And part of the reason is that this money is disappearing offshore. There's a fascinating, extraordinary figure, which is that world tax authorities worldwide have collected $500 million as a result of the publication of the Panama Papers.
Wow.
So this is just one firm. It was one of the top four or five in the world, certainly incorporating these anonymous shell companies, but just one firm. And as a result of the publication of these stories and of the database that ICIJ put out on its website, icij.org, tax authorities have collected $500 million in taxes that were evaded.
So why in the past, and I guess this really doesn't come from the IRS, this collection of money, why have they been so ineffectual in stamping out these offshore abuses?
That's an excellent question. In my book, Secrecy World, I have an entire chapter about the IRS, and in particular, the story of this incredible IRS agent named Joe West, who was actually given the time and resources to do a deep dive into offshore tax evasion by Americans. And he goes on this journey, figures out exactly how it's being done in different ways, and presents his bosses with a whole menu of ways that they can go after this. They end up choosing only one option on that menu and are quite successful in some way. But Joe West is so sort of frustrated by, you know, the bureaucracy he has to battle through just to do that, that he ends up retiring early. So part of it is a lack of political will and sort of inertia and things like that that afflict big bureaucracies like the IRS. But part of it is also the fact that the IRS has been hogtied by Congress, which has radically slashed its budget and made it almost impossible for the IRS to do its job. So it's a bunch of different factors, but clearly it would be possible to go after this tax evasion if the political will existed.
So you mentioned earlier that the Panama Papers implicated Vladimir Putin in certain ways. Tell us about that.
Well, this is an extraordinary story. We found a network of companies that were set up by this bank in St. Petersburg called Bank Rossiya, which goes way back with Putin, even before he was a political person, when he worked in the municipality of St. Petersburg. And the chairman of this bank has actually been called by the U.S. Treasury Department Putin's personal banker. So this bank sets up this network of companies, and two of the companies, the ostensible owner of these companies is a classical cellist by the name of Sergei Roldugin. And Sergei Roldugin, up until now, had never even been considered a businessman. I mean, he was not a financial guy at all. He's actually a fairly well-known and renowned cellist. But he also happens to be the godfather of Vladimir Putin's eldest daughter and one of Putin's oldest friends. And so he is the owner of these companies that are doing incredibly complex financial activities, including the potential takeover of Russia's largest truck manufacturer and major inroads into Russia's media. And so they're doing these things as part of a network of companies set up by this bank through which billions of dollars are moving, including possibly billions of dollars from state-controlled banks in Russia. And it all revolves around a group of people connected and close to Vladimir Putin, including some of his oldest friends and oligarchs who have risen up with him and who are protected by him. So for the first time, I mean, there's been speculation for years that Putin actually might be one of the wealthiest people on the planet.
I've heard that.
He has always denied, but we've never been able to see how his money moves and how it actually works. And it seems like a large part of it is going through this secrecy world and to some degree through Mossack Fonseca, although they use lots and lots of different firms, obviously.
And based on the structure, the political structure in Russia, nothing significant, especially when it comes to this type of money movement, will be not under the eye of the grandmaster. He has that much control over the oligarchy, as you said.
Well, it's amazing, Steve. I mean, if you are a businessman of some size and influence in Russia, you want Vladimir Putin to have a piece of your business.
Yeah, of course.
Because he will provide protection.
That's insurance.
And so you're happy if he takes an interest and wants to participate because it means that you will have this protection. I mean, it is a kleptocracy, and that is how a kleptocracy works.
The book is Secrecy World: Inside the Panama Papers, Investigation of Illicit Money Networks and the Global Elite. My guest is Jake Bernstein, and you can find him at jakebernstein.net. To hear this again, listen to the full show, or to get a summary of the vital info discussed here today, go to stevepomerantz.com. And while you're there, sign up for our weekly update, where we will send you the weekly commentaries and all the interviews from the show on a weekly basis. And we've included searchable archives now if you think you've missed something, and that'll come straight into your inbox weekly. Jake Bernstein, thank you so much. Great information.
Thank you, Steve.
I'd like to take a moment to thank all the people involved in the making of this show. Senior producer Erica Stamolo, engineer Brian Zykowitz, senior editor Carol Melzone, and John Sova, who handles our digital platform. And of course, finally, contributor Terry Story. You know, I just want to remind you that any interviewee's appearance on the Steve Pomerantz Show does not represent any endorsement or confer any opinion whatsoever, either positive or negative, by the Steve Pomerantz Show or any media by which the Steve Pomerantz Show is distributed. Thank you so much for joining us.
Investing involves risk, and listeners should carefully consider their own investment objectives and never rely on any single chart, graph, or marketing piece to make decisions. The radio show is intended for informational purposes only, is not a recommendation to buy or sell any securities, and should not be considered tax, legal, investment advice. Please contact your tax, legal, financial professional with questions about your specific needs and circumstances. The information in the show is obtained from sources believed to be reliable. However, their accuracy and completeness cannot be guaranteed. All data are driven from publicly available information and has not been independently verified by United Capital. Neither United Capital nor any of its affiliates makes any representation or warranty as to the accuracy or completeness of the information contained in this recording, and any liability as a result of this recording is expressly disclaimed. This recording should not be relied upon to evaluate any potential transaction. United Capital is not giving tax, legal, investment advice by means of this recording, and this recording does not establish a client relationship with United Capital.